to Turkey there, so you can see the whole eastern coast of the Mediterranean. We're going to zoom in on that squared area there, which now you can see is Acts chapter 9. In Acts chapter 9, we begin in Jerusalem. Saul is persecuting the saints. He's going to go up here to Damascus to do that. Somewhere on the road, he meets the Lord. And somewhere on the road, it's decision time. So he is led by the hand into Damascus. He is baptized into Christ by Ananias. He learns he is going to be a voice for his God. Now, though, last week I made a mistake because what this chart does not show is a trip to Arabia and then a return to Damascus before then, as you see on the lines, comes back to Jerusalem, Caesarea, and eventually up to Tarsus there. But in Galatians chapter 1, verses 17 and 18, we have some information there that Ron pointed out to me after class last week, and I just was having one of those mental glitches, you know. But chapter 1, verses 17 and 18 says, I went away to Arabia and returned once more to Damascus. Then, 3 years later, I went up to Jerusalem to become acquainted with Cephas, and I stayed with him 15 days. So, where was he for 3 years? Damascus. Why did I say Arabia? But Ron caught it, I really appreciate it, so I planted the wrong idea last week. That he was actually 3 years in Damascus, and we've talked about that, you know, at some length. Now, we've actually come down to about verse 31, but I wanted to spend some time this morning on Acts chapter 9 and verse 26. Greg here had asked me a couple of times about it in the last few weeks and had a question that was framed, you know, something like, well, here it is, this. In Acts chapter 9, verse 26, when he came to Jerusalem, he was trying to associate with the disciples in the New American Standard or join the disciples in the New King James or King James, but they were all afraid of him, not believing he was a disciple. Well, we're talking about Saul of Tarsus, who had been his persecutor, and whose conversion we just read about in the first part right here. He wanted to do something in Acts 9:26. What was it? He was trying to do this thing. So apparently he was very eager about it. He was very energetic about it. He was quite intent on it. It was something that he didn't do just once. He kept doing it. And it's very active there, what we have in the verse. He was trying to associate with the disciples and really failing, but not giving up. He wanted this thing to happen. And they're scared to death, and they've got good reason for that. But now the question comes up, does join equal place membership the way that we usually think of it today? And that's a great question. And very timely, too. Ramona said last week that she wanted to place membership. She wanted to join the church here at Coburn Road. And Angela Lightning Bolt has come very close to her decision to be baptized into Christ. I think probably next Sunday. And so, you know, we'll see if that takes place. But both of them are now thinking in terms of placing a membership with the congregation here at Coburn Road. Now, the first thing I'd like to do here as we do this little study, and very rapidly, is to just admit, you know, probably not. Probably your idea of what placing membership is not, or the procedure for it, is not what Paul was doing. But we need to talk about that a little bit. So, we're going to do it for just a little bit, and my apologies, Greg, I know you're very interested in this, but I'm not going to have any time for questions or discussion, you know, afterwards. I'm going to go through a bunch of slides. I spent too much time on this already. I got carried away with it because it was so interesting. I appreciated the opportunity, but it's going to take a lot of time that I'd rather not. So, I'm just going to run through it. If you have questions afterwards, you know, we'll talk about it ourselves. But first, you know, I'd say probably not for this reason. I don't know what everybody thinks. So, I don't know what you're thinking when you want to place membership. I don't know what anybody's thinking when they want to place membership. So I have to explore that. I have to investigate that. What is going on in their head? What are they thinking about? Now, remember this, though. Whatever is going on in the first place, Paul really wanted to get this done, and he wouldn't give up until he got it accomplished. So whatever it was really important to Paul. It was not a secondary thing. It was not, you know, a casual thing. It was important to him. But I'm thinking that this idea of place membership is maybe kind of like this term, take communion. What Bible verse mentions taking communion? And that's a trick question, isn't it? What Bible verse uses the phrase? None. How often do we use the phrase? A lot. Where did we get it? Roman Catholicism. What's that got to do with us or the Bible? Nothing. So when somebody talks about taking communion, you better what? You better start asking some questions. They have a Catholic background like I do. Their conception of the term is utterly different than what ours is. But off the bat, we have to admit, brethren, there's no such thing in the Bible as placing membership. Kinda. And there's no such thing in the Bible as taking communion either. But what? Kinda. Jen? Okay, we're going to get to it in just a minute. I appreciate the question. We're going to talk about this in just a minute. How about this term, disfellowship? Raise your hand if you ever used that term. What verse did you find it in? Speak where the Bible speaks, and silent where the Bible is silent, unless we're talking about placing membership, taking communion, or disfellowshipping somebody. And then, we just use those terms, you know, indiscriminately. What does disfellowship mean? Well, I don't know what's going on in your head. Okay? And so we got to be careful with these terms. That's why we're going to take the time to do it. These are not Bible words, you know, admittedly. But they do represent ideas that are biblical. Something happened in Acts 9. It's going to happen elsewhere too. What is it? Pretty important to a brand new Christian by the name of Saul. His name hasn't been changed to Paul yet. Pretty important to him, and he's not going to give up until he gets it done. Now, if you have Strong's Concordance and you do the numbering system and all that, you know, then the number is 2853 in the New Testament. It's kalao is the word that we're talking about right here. It's pronounced kalao, comes from the word kola, but look what it means. It means glue. What he was trying to do was not going to be impermanent or temporary. He was thinking in terms of glomming on. He wanted to glue himself to those disciples. Then, this word means, you know, to stick. It's translated join or associate, but it's join like you do with glue. It's associate like you do with rivets, you know, like you do with stuff that you want to stay together. It's only used 12 times in the New Testament. We're going to look at 7, you know, and if you want, you can do the Strong's Concordance or whatever. You can ask me to get the rest of it, but I think the point will be made and we won't have to do all of them. Matthew 19, verses 5, 6, and 7. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be what to his wife? How casual a relationship is that? How unimportant is it? The same word, what do you think a marriage is about? Well, that's a union, isn't it? That's an association. And the two shall become one flesh, so they're no longer two but one flesh. But therefore God is joined. It might be hard to read there. That's a different word. It's a little unfortunate. It's very similar in idea, but it's a totally different word. So I just want to point out, it's not used twice in this context. But what therefore God is joined together, let no man separate. Well, what was the point of this up here, though? And so what we're talking about when this word was used here was a relationship that you really need and you really want and you intend when you enter into it to do it very purposely, and then you'll stay that way. This, you know, is permanent. And God is involved when it comes to the marriage. In Luke chapter 10, whatever city you enter and they do not receive you, go out into the streets and say, even the dust of your city which clings to our feet, we wipe off and protest against you. The idea of the word is that you're going to have to do something to get it off. It's glued. It's a part of you. And so now it would take an effort to disrupt it, to do something to change that relationship. When he had spent everything in Luke 15, a severe famine occurred in that country, and he began to be in need, and he went and attached himself to one of the citizens of that country, and he sent him into his fields to feed swine. Now, notice how many different words are being used for this same word. It makes it kind of hard in your Bible study because, you know, as you're reading through, you're not seeing the same word every time. But all these words in English have the same idea, don't they? You're glued. You're stuck. You're joined. You're attached. You're associated. See, you're together, and it's supposed to stay that way. So this man, apparently, complete poverty, found one guy that would allow him to stay there with him and work for him. So he took a job there. Well, apparently, he'd be living with the guy as well, and essentially he's become a slave. Now, in Acts 5, great fear came upon the whole church and upon all who heard of these things, and at the hands of the apostles, many signs and wonders were taking place among the people. This is Ananias and Sapphira's death. And they were all of one accord and saw a portico, but none of the rest dared to associate with them. However, the people held them in high esteem. And this one's particularly helpful in our Bible study here, brethren. Is it a good thing to have high esteem for a people that you're not going to associate with? Is that a good idea? I don't think so. These people were afraid to take the step that Paul was so interested in accomplishing, that he had to fight his way through some obstacles to make it happen. These people hold in high esteem, but they're not what? They're not joining. They're not gluing. They're not sticking. They're not associating. They're not, you know, pleasing. They're not clinging. All these terms are used depending on the translation you go to. Acts 17. Paul went out of their midst, but some men joined him and believed. Among whom also were Dionysius the Areopagite and a woman named Damaris and others with him. Now at this point, with all of these, I think you're beginning to see something too. A relationship changed. When you do this joining, a relationship that might have been really close and regular, you know, who knows how long that these men were studying, but now they're going to do something else. They're going to join him. So, among whom also Dionysius, you know, they joined him and believed. What that suggests there, putting the two together like it does, is that, you know, when you make up your mind you're a saint, you're a believer, you accept this, you're on board, then what should you do? Hold in high respect and at arm's length? No, what do? You join them. You get on board. You get involved. You get into it. Abhor what is evil, cling to what is good. I guess I got ahead of myself on that one. I used cling earlier. And these are all, I'm quoting New American Standard, but wanted you to show how many different ways that they translate it. Do you not know that the one who joins himself to a prostitute is one body with her? For he says, the two shall become one flesh. But the one who joins himself to the Lord is one spirit with him. Brother, the only time that this verse was used in a temporary relationship was with what? It was with a prostitute. And even then, the physical relationship is as dramatically, you know, illustrative of what we're talking about as anything can be. And then it's just terrible that you would do that. Don't do that. That's the antithesis of what joining is supposed to be. Joining is supposed to be a conscious decision to spend your life glued to somebody, something, or a church, the disciples, that, you know, Paul wasn't about to do without. So, and it is used twice in that particular verse. Okay, so that brings back to Acts chapter 9, verse 26. When he came to Jerusalem, he's been a Christian for how long? Years. But he's never been to Jerusalem. So now, what does he do? He wants to do something with the disciples in Jerusalem. What is it? He wants to be a part of them. He doesn't want to be just a visitor. He doesn't want to be somebody that respects you but doesn't want to be a part of you. He's a guy who wants to be associated, glued, clinging, cleaving, joining the disciples. And they wouldn't let him. So, what happens? Now, let's come back to Acts chapter 9, verse 26. When he came to Jerusalem, he was trying to associate with the disciples. They were all afraid of him, not believing he was a disciple. But Barnabas took hold of him, brought him to the apostles, described to them how he had seen the Lord on the road, that he had talked to him, and how at Damascus he had spoken out boldly in the name of Jesus, and he was with them. We had already been there for some time. He had already been respected by some, Barnabas himself. But what was he not? He wasn't with them yet. Now, great, you're breaking the rules. Really briefly. Yeah, it's an English problem. That's why we went back to glue.
That Greek word is the same way. Now, you look at this verse in Acts 9:26, and you take one chapter before it and one chapter after it. Luke uses that same Greek word when Philip was to go and overtake the church. Okay. Now, how long was Philip there with the Ethiopian community? Probably not very long. They had a conversation about that.
Okay, yeah, all true. All true. Could this word be used of two pieces of wood? Could the word be used, you know, in any number of different ways? Right. But when you're talking about a relationship with a church, then what? Now, if I go on a vacation, what am I going to do? I'm going to join myself to that local church. Don and I never take a vacation. He did first thing. Where are we going to worship when we get there? So, now that we've made up our minds on where we can worship, we know where we can go. So now, where we take this vacation, we're going to go. How long are we going to be there with those saints? So we're going to join them in their worship for how long? That's great. Okay? And the nature of the game is, I'm what? A temporary visitor, so I'm leaving town. But as long as I'm there, what am I going to do? That's where I'm going to be. But I think that's what Paul was doing here. I don't think he was just a visitor. I think Paul was somebody who said, look, I need to be recognized as somebody that is a part of this local congregation here. Okay? Jerry.
The words that you have shown us can be used in different situations and describing different things. And that tells you, as Thayer does in his introduction to his book, that context always determines the use of a word. It may be a word with a given definition, and that definition may apply in different ways in different situations, but the context determines what that word means in that given point. What we have here, and the American Standard translates this as trying to associate. The old King James, New King James, perhaps other translations say he was trying to join. It's interesting that different Greek word, koinonia, which translates fellowship, but its English synonyms are to have communion, joint participation, association. And so what we're looking at here is Paul attempting to become a part of what these brethren here are doing in fellowship with them. And when that was established, then we see him coming in and going out with them. So this is not a temporary situation, except for when Paul would now leave this community, that he's no longer joined to them locally.
See, that's exactly it. And so, yeah, you could join for a very short moment. But not if you're living in the town. That's something else. Now, let's go on, because I'm already running out of time here. And I've got several more things to do. Just remember this in your studies. at first, so much appreciate what Jerry did there. There's so much more we could do. I'm just trying to limit myself to the use of the word joined in Acts 9:26. Your need to be a member of a body in a local congregation is just spread all over the Bible. You know, I can't take the time for it. Here, it means glue. That's what Paul was trying to do. So your concepts of placing membership, what was going on in Acts 9:26, need also to be very much colored by a lot of study we're not going to do at all, and then just this little thing that I want you to remember. Remember this. Next three verses. Not using the word joined. Titus 3. Remind them to be subject to rulers, to authorities, to be obedient, to be ready for every good deed, to malign no one, to be peaceable, gentle, showing every consideration for all men. Now that's a very general subject. It's got a lot of different admonitions in it. But remember our studies from the last couple of weeks in Ephesians 5. That whole body there at the end of chapter 5 and the first part of chapter 6 in Ephesians was all about what? Submission. Subjection. Learning how to control yourself and to arrange yourself under other people. Well, that's the general title here. Be subject to rulers. Or elders, for instance, rulers. Well, of course they are, and they're called that. That's their job. To authorities of every kind, but elders are one kind. Be obedient. Now watch what happens in Hebrews 13. Obey your leaders. There's that word again. Leaders. Rulers. Submit to them. For they keep watch over your souls as those who will give an account. Let them do this with joy and not with grief. For this would be unprofitable for you. So what now if the one of the larger character traits of Christians, and I mean larger, because if the first is love, what is love? When you subject yourself to somebody else's best interest, isn't it? It's very hard to guess what it is. Love is when I do for somebody else instead of for me. It is learning to put my needs and desires and thoughts and everything aside and below somebody else. Well, you know, next only to love, I guess, you're going to find discussions in your Bible everywhere about submission, subjection, this spirit that learns to get along with people and to be humble. What does that mean? Not thinking you're better and smarter than everybody else. You can go with the leadership that's expressed. Obey them, and if you don't, well then what? You're the one that's in trouble. You're causing them grief, but you're the one that's in trouble. Did you have a hand up? Okay, go ahead. Everything in what?
In sincerity.
Yes.
You just do it all in sincerity. That's what's right.
You take care of yourself. Okay. Now, one last one in 1 Peter. I exhort the elders. Now, it is the word elder, as opposed to leader, ruler. As your fellow elder and witness of the sufferings of Christ, partaker also of the glory that is to be revealed. Shepherd the flock of God among you. Exercising oversight. Not under compulsion, but voluntarily, according to the will of God, and not for sordid gain, but with eagerness, nor yet as lording it over those allotted to your charge. Allotted to your charge? But proving the examples to the flock, and when the chief shepherd appears, you'll receive the unfading crown of glory. You younger men likewise be what? You better do this. And if you don't, who's going to pay for it ultimately? You're going to pay for it. This is a relationship in which the elders, okay, shepherd a flock. What must they then have? Some way of identifying who's in the what? You're either in or you're out. You're either glued or you're not. You're either associating or not. You're clinging, you're cleaving. You're part of the flock or you're not. Paul wanted which? He wanted in. Not out. So that these kinds of things can take place. Not the sort of game, nor yet as Lord yet, proving to be example. When the chief shepherd appears, you'll receive the unfading crown of glory. You younger men likewise, be subject to them. If a man or a woman is in an area where you have a group of disciples that have elders, and you choose not to get in. You don't want to be in subjection. You don't want to be associating, joining. You don't want to have them ruling, leading, so that you're obedient. You got problems, and you're in trouble. It's bad, and don't let that happen. Now, you younger men, pointing back there at you, because you're the youngest guy in the room. It's not personal. It's hard for younger men, and you're supposed to grow out of it. It's hard for a young man. He knows he's faster than everybody else. He knows he's smarter than everybody else. You know, I had to get up in years I taught driver's ed and tell those kids that they were all faster thinkers than I was. I never liked that class. We were talking about reaction times. And I had to tell them, look, I'm 45, you're 15. You're faster than I am. You see a problem, you can get your foot off that accelerator and onto that brake in less time than I can. And you know why? It's because you think faster than I can, too. Do you know what else I got to tell my kids? That you don't think as good as I do. That's why you're in trouble. I don't ever let myself get that close. So you're relying on speed, and you're developing a confidence that kills how many people every year? Okay? Teenagers, second, suicide is second only to this. I digress. Anyway, you know, when we put this together, what you've got as you look at the overview of the Bible is not 9:26. Acts 9:26 is easy to kind of set aside and say, well, you know. Wait a minute. There's a whole concept of humility, subjection, participation, fellowship that Jerry introduced. All these ideas are balled up in an individual who says, I really want to be a part of that, and I'm not going to let anything stand in my way. And once I get in, I'm going to humbly be in submission to those elders so that we as a body can get things done that I as an individual am not going to be able to get done. Now, I see you squirming there, but I just can't, Greg. Look, one last thing, and I've got to get through the end of the chapter. Look, placing membership is not a Bible term. It's in the Bible. How you go about doing it is up to each individual eldership / local congregation. That's why you don't have, I think, some specific way of going about doing this. Circumstances are different. So, being a part of a congregation is a thing that's just everywhere in the Bible. It's not a Bible term, and it's also subject to the procedure. So, Ramona, get ready. The elders probably already given you a sheet of paper that talks about what this congregation is about. They're going to want to study with you. And it's not because they're trying to throw you out. It's because they love you and they want to get to know you. You're going to become part of a flock over which they are elders, and they have a responsibility that they'll have to answer to God for. And so they want you to know what you're getting into. It's called counting the cost. Now, when you count the cost, it's really not that high. And it should never be for anybody too high. Okay? So remember, it's not a Bible term, but it represents union with a local church. And that certainly is a Bible concept. And one thing I just thought I'd throw this in for free. Brethren, if everybody avoided membership, there'd be 7 fewer books in the Bible. Why? What would we not have if everybody took the approach of, I don't want to be a part of a local congregation. I'm not going to be in submission to the elders. I'm not going to be in then what? You got 7 books that are addressed to what? To a church that you didn't want to be a part of. Well, what are you going to do with that? That really sobered me up, and until this study, again, I want to thank Greg for it. I've never thought about that before, what it would mean if we took away the whole concept of placing membership, if we did away with that. One other thing we've never had is disfellowship. And I'd be wondering about your communion. Since you really don't want to be joined to us. And when we all eat, we're showing something. Not just, I think, brethren, that we're part of the body of Christ, which is certainly true. But if we're a part of that body, then we're a part of you working together to get the work of that body done on this earth. So I just toss that one because I never thought about that before. Okay. So back to Acts, everybody. Let's come on over to chapter 9. And we're going to pick up again in our study with Paul in his travel. Peter in his travel. So we're setting up now in Jerusalem, going to go to Lydda, then to Joppa, and eventually up here to Caesarea. we're turning the corner now to go back and talk now about Peter. We've got Paul's conversion in chapter 9. We're leaving Paul altogether. We're going to go back to Peter. Now notice here that it's about 25 miles from Jerusalem to Lydda. Nowhere in Israel is really terribly difficult elevation-wise. You know, even walk everything, it's not like you have to get a rope, you know, to do it. But there are, you know, some valleys and some work that's involved there. So 25 miles to Jerusalem, for people in that culture, that is probably about two-thirds to three-quarters of a day's journey. It's a pretty good full journey. When I did my hike in Israel, I did one hike of 14 and a half miles and almost killed me. Okay? I was 59 years old. I had worked out really hard, you know, to get myself in shape. 14 and a half miles, though, it was a lot of work. These people were born and bred to that. You know, when I was in the Philippines, I saw this, and they'll just walk circles around it. So it's a day's journey, or somewhat less, from one to the other. From Lydda to Joppa is 11 miles. So a smaller distance here, you can see about half of that. So first we're going to go to Lydda. We have experience there. Then we're going to go to Joppa and have a tremendous miracle there. Okay, and then at the end of the chapter, which we'll get to in about 10 minutes if I'm lucky, we have 30 miles from here to here. Okay? From Joppa, a seaport, Caesarea, a seaport, you have approximately 30 miles. Now you're kind of pushing it. You know, I would absolutely not have been able to do that in a single day. It's just out of the question. There are probably people, you know, like the Hebert brothers who could. You know, those days are gone for me. Now, here's a pencil sketch of Lydda. I have a collection of a couple of hundred of these, which I'm really proud of, so I try to show them off every chance I can. An artist in the 1800s stood there and drew that. Okay? So I just love these because they didn't have photography, and we can get back now, you know, in the early 1800s and see a thing that only an artist could give us, and there are not a whole lot of them that have done it for us, a few. So here's what Lydda was. It's what you call nondescript, isn't it? It's just, you know, a pretty flat area, you know, and you look at the horizon, there's hardly any hills or anything, you know, it's just not a whole lot going on there as far as magnificence, you know, geographically. But here's what takes place. Starting in verse 31. Paul, remember now, at verse 30, his brethren learned that they brought him down to Caesarea, sent him away to Tarsus. So he'd hit the coast and then gone north. Now in 31. The church throughout all Judea and Galilee and Samaria enjoyed peace, being built up and going on in the fear of the Lord and in the comfort of the Holy Spirit. It continued to increase. Now that's interesting, because we had quite a persecution that had gotten started back there because of Stephen's death in 7 and there at the start of 8 and with Paul's activity too. But they got a respite. Please don't think of persecution as being a constant thing. It was rising and falling with all kinds of local circumstances, political circumstances, various levels of Roman and Jewish government. There were so many power plays and things involved in this. Do not think that persecution was a given in the first century and any other time. It's not. But it was there, elsewhere. And for a little while right now, at least, Judea, Galilee, and Samaria, they get a respite. They're built up. They're going on in the fear of the Lord. They're in the comfort of the Holy Spirit. They're continuing to increase. And so things are going really well. Now 32. It came about that as Peter was traveling through all those parts, he came down also to the saints who lived at Lydda. There he found a certain man named Aeneas, who had been bedridden 8 years, for he was paralyzed. And Peter said to him, Aeneas, Jesus Christ heals you. Now, that's an interesting insight right here. The form that this healing takes. How careful is Peter? Who healed him? Jesus did this. Not me. Jesus did this. Now, by the way, can Jesus fail? No. Now, I've met dozens and dozens of people today, Pentecostal preachers, who fail the vast majority of the time. And every time they do, who do they blame it on? Well, you didn't have enough faith. Now, if they set out to heal somebody and they are what they claim to be, then can they fail? Yeah. Okay? So he just gives an order. Jesus doesn't fail. Others may, but then they don't have Jesus. Jesus heals you. Rise, make your bed. So what did he do? Must come out like a jack-in-the-box, right? That leap might have been 3 feet off the ground. Noah, who lived at Lydda and Sharon, neighboring, saw him, and they did what? Turned to the Lord. Now, here's a tiny little town. It's not influential by any means. It's not the seat of a Jewish government or a Roman government. It's not a mercantile. It's just a tiny little podunk town. I doubt it had 1,000 people in it. I mean, that's small. And so, what do they get, though, like everybody else in this time? Miracles. So they'll do what? Turn to the Lord. So they'll believe and turn to the Lord. So, in those days when miracles were taking place, when miracles were happening, when you could unfailingly heal somebody, did you only go to the big towns, have a big rally, tens of thousands of people, and little places you just skip? No. What were you doing? Everywhere you went, no matter who you were with, no matter what time of day, how many people, or any of the circumstances, if you can work miracles, then when can you work miracles? Anywhere, everywhere, whenever you want. And if you can work miracles, you cannot fail. That can only come through the power of Jesus Christ. Fail at a miracle, you have just demonstrated not with Christ. Okay? Now, next thing we want to talk about is this next city. We've got about 5 minutes here. So in 36, in Joppa, right, look at your text, in Joppa, there was a certain disciple named Tabitha, which translated in Greek is called Dorcas. This woman was abounding with deeds of kindness and charity, which she continually did. Came about at that time, she fell sick and died, and when they had washed her body, they laid it in an upper room. And since Lydda was near what? Joppa. Okay. The disciples, having heard that Peter was there, sent two men to him entreating him, do not delay to come to us, and so he did. Now, this is Joppa. Let me go back a second. This is Joppa, but it's not Joppa. It's Joppa. And I learned this the hard way. I got lost in Jerusalem one day. I was on foot. I was just having a good time. Jerusalem's not a very big town. It was, you know, they're terrible, but I got lost. So I went up to this poor woman and I asked her how to get to the Joppa Gate. The Joppa Gate is the most famous, I guess, or one of, in all of Jerusalem. I want to go back to the Joppa Gate so I can get inside the city itself. She goes, Joppa Gate. Joppa Gate. What? What? And I remembered, oh yeah, where am I? I'm not in an English speaking town anymore. Where am I? I said, Joppa Gate. Oh, what are you doing today? so stupid. So we get pronunciations going on all the time now, brother. We really, don't know what we're talking about. I don't think it matters. But we should just be alert to that. Anytime you meet somebody that actually speaks Hebrew, that's a time to learn some things, try to get that much closer to the scriptures. But you see how there's this very natural little hill right here? It's really neat when you go there. It's only a couple hundred feet high. In any direction, you can come on down into the town right here. Now, it looks like a lot of town, but you're going to see in a minute, really, this is Tel Aviv, and it's the capital of Israel. It's the biggest town in Israel. And like anywhere, it's spreading out. It's engulfing what was Joppa. Okay? Joppa was a seaport. Too bad this didn't come out just a little bit farther, but you can't even see this boat right here, go in quite a bit further there. And so a lot of boats and fishermen and whatnot that's going on. But that's it. And it's a town that comes up several times in both the Old Testament and the New. Now, if you were standing on the beach and you were looking at Joppa, then from Tel Aviv side, then this is what it looks like. And I want you to notice this spire, these three levels right here. That's one building in your typical Catholic spire. It's a big church building that Catholics have set up. This is a preceding picture again. See, there's your tower. there's the levels on the building right there. So it's the most prominent thing on the hill right now, and really easy to get oriented, you know, find your way around right there. Okay, but this is what it looks like when you're at beach level, and just looking across very little water, you know, you can see the beaches right there on your left. That is the town of Yafa today, and you see the breakwater on the right. This is what it looks like to stand at the place we were just looking at and look back at Tel Aviv. So that's Tel Aviv. What's your picture of Israel? What do you think Israel looks like? Does that come to something of a shock? You know, usually all you ever see is Jerusalem and various Bible sites, and you don't realize that, you know, it's a regular place. And it's got as much business. In fact, it's kind of the Silicon Valley of the Middle East. Notoriously renowned for having brilliant minds in the software and computer industry. We have many industries, you know, that are going on in the town. But if you're standing there at Yafa, that's what you'd be looking at if you were Jonah, maybe, looking for a boat. Or, now you can see it. This was all you could see before, maybe up to that point right there. You see, you know, pretty far back. And there's your aerial view. And here's the church that we were talking about, you know, with that spire. Here's the park that you can go into. Really pretty. They've got a neat little bridge right in there. We parked our bus down. This has been right here in this corner, I think, and walked up through here. Mediterranean, of course, really, really beautiful. It's just a great, you know, little place. Now, I'm out of town time, and I'm also out of town here, maybe, but let me just hit you with this slide, and I'll try to finish the chapter. This is Caesarea. Tonight, I'm going to spend all our time on Caesarea. I was extremely blessed and privileged to know Farrell Jenkins at all. But then travel with a man, you know, who had been 41 times to Israel. And then after the tour left, I stayed with him a week, just the two of us, and we went exploring and decided to charter a private plane. So it was just the pilot and the two of us. And we got to circle here. This is the photo I took myself, you know, from the air. But tonight we're going to see a lot more of these. And so I just want to encourage everybody, you know, come back tonight. Caesarea is much more prominent in the Bible, especially in the book of Acts, than Yafa is. But it's just right up the coast there, what I say, about 30 miles, I think. So that's what we'll be studying here tonight. Now, back to this passage. In Yafa, verse 36, there was a certain disciple named Tabitha, which translated is called Dorcas. This woman, abounding with deeds of kindness and charity, which she continually did. May we all be such a woman. Came about, she fell sick, she died, they washed her body, laid it in an upper room. Funerals, burials, much more personal then they are now. 38. Since Lydda was near, the disciples, having heard Peter was there, sent two men to him, entreating him, "Do not delay to come to us." Peter arose and went with them. When he had come, they brought him into the upper room. All the widows stood beside him weeping, showing all the tunics and garments that Dorcas used to make while she was with them. Imagine the scene. And Peter sent them all out, knelt down, prayed. He turned to the body and he said, "Tabitha, if you've got faith enough." She's dead. It's not her faith that's involved here. He said, "Tabitha, what? Rise." She opened her eyes. She saw Peter. She sat up. He gave her his hand, raised her up, calling the saints and the widows. Now he opens the door. He presents her alive. Can you imagine what it looked like when he brought her through that door? Became known all over Yafa. And many believed in the Lord. It came about that he stayed many days in Yafa with a certain tanner named Simon, who we will learn in verse 6 of chapter 10, lived where? Somewhere right in this. That has always been the port of Yafa for now 3,000, 4,000 years. He lives somewhere along in this.